All right, I want to pick up what we left off in the book of Isaiah. We left off in chapter 46. If anybody needs a Bible, I think we have a couple of extra ones there. But let's just get right into it. Isaiah writes this. He says in verse 1 of chapter 46 of Isaiah, he says, Baal has bowed down, Nabal stoops over, the images are consigned to the beast and the cattle. The things that you carry are burdensome, a load for the weary beast. They stooped over, they have bowed down together, they could not rescue the burden. But they have themselves gone into captivity. Listen to me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel. You have been born by me from birth, and you have been carried from the womb. Even to your old age I will be the same, and even to your graying years I will bear you. I have done it, and I will carry you, and I will bear you, and I will deliver you. To whom would you liken me, and make me equal, and compare me, that we would be alike? Hey, before we go any further, I just want to back up here and break this down to what Isaiah is saying. Once again, I mean, I think it's very, very profound if you just stop and analyze it, because he says Baal has bowed down. Now, I don't know, some Bibles may say Marduk, but he's talking about here these Babylonian gods. Now, here's the thing. Babylon at this particular time was almost just a province of Assyria. It wasn't a dominant world power, but Isaiah keeps predicting that they will become a world power, and that because of Israel's wickedness, Judah's wickedness, God would use the Babylonians to chasten his people, that they would go into captivity, but eventually God would judge Babylon, which of course he certainly did with the Medes and the Persians. But interesting thing, and I had shared this last week in regards to, you go back to the book of Daniel, and it was during that drunken bash that Belshazzar was having with all of his nobles, that was the night that Babylon was overrun by the Medes and the Persians. That was the night when they were all getting drunk with all the utensils from the temple, and then this hand comes out and writes on a wall, "Meeny, meeny, take ill a parson," and then the king turns white as a sheet, and then his knees are knocking together, and he knows this can't be good news because his own conscience is convicting him. And anyway, his wise men and his conjurers and his astrologers, nobody could figure it out until Daniel came in here and says, "Hey, man, this means you've been weighed in the balances and been found wanting, and your kingdom has been divided among the Medes and the Persians." And that night, Babylon was overrun by the Medes and the Persians, and Belshazzar was killed. But when they were overrun, this is a prediction of what's going to happen when the Medes and the Persians breached the wall, and they went under, basically they went under the wall because they were able to divert the moat and the river that was used to have that moat around the wall, and they diverted it, and they just walked underneath the walls, and they conquered Babylon. And this is amazing, the way he predicted this before Babylon even rose to power. But then when they were invaded, this is what these priests do. It says a lot to me, because it says Baal has bowed down. Some Bibles may say Marduk, and that was basically the supreme god and the whole pantheon of the Babylonian gods. And Nabal stoops over. That was kind of like the god of the scribes, the god of the intellect, the god of wisdom, that type of thing. That was their god. But then what's interesting is what happened when they got invaded. This was predicted, because Baal has bowed down, Nabal has stooped over, their images are consigned to the beast and the cattle. What does that mean? What does he mean that their images, their idols, are consigned to the beast and the cattle? What does it mean?
They're brainless.
Well, not only that, but when they were invaded by the Medes and the Persians, the priests of these idols started loading them up on carts, to haul them away in running from their enemy. Now, what kind of God is that? That's what he's saying. Yeah. People can look at this and say, well, that was thousands of years ago. It's got nothing to do with us. But I certainly see it. I see it. It just jumps out at me. I see it clear as day that we do the same thing today in regards to our own images. And I'll give you an example. I know I don't want to beat this to death, and I know that people will be all over me for saying this, but I'm telling you, when I read something like this about all these false gods, I can't help but look at our sacred cows today. Our sacred cows.
Oh.
One of the biggest sacred cows today, in my opinion, is evolution. Now, I know that people, you can believe in evolution to still be saved, all right? And I know that there are Christians who believe it. There are scientists who are Christians who believe it. That's fine. But I'm telling you right now, I don't buy it. It's a bunch of bunk, and I don't buy it. And they have to keep doing everything they possibly can to keep this stupid, idiotic idol, this sacred cow, erect. And I was just reading this clipping out of the USA Today, and it happens to deal with this Stephen Hawking. He's this British scientist. He's a brilliant, brilliant man. And unfortunately, he suffers from this ALS, you know, this disease that attacks his motor ability, all right? And he's a brilliant man, but unfortunately, he's the one that says, because there is a law such as gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing, writes Hawking, who collaborated with authors and physicists and these other people. And he says basically that because of the law of gravity, you can explain how the universe came into existence without God. Now, this is a brilliant man. He's brilliant, and I know that people will just look at me with the utmost contempt, but I'm telling you, this guy here, as much as I feel sorry for him because of his disease, I get angry with these people. I really do, because they will say anything and do anything to just push God out of the picture. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that's a Nabal. That's Marduk. That's Baal. And I think I was sharing last week, I had read years ago about a situation with Watchman Nee. He was a pastor in China, and when he was a young pastor, him and some other Chinese nationals, they went to this province over there in China and trying to witness to other Chinese people about Jesus Christ, and nobody was interested. They weren't hostile towards their message, but they just didn't give a hoot about it until finally some of the Christians just said, well, what's the deal? Why aren't you interested in Jesus Christ? They said, well, we got our own God, Tai Wang, man. We don't need Jesus Christ. And as a matter of fact, tomorrow is Tai Wang's feast day. And they said, well, what's so great about Tai Wang? He says, well, it never rains on his feast day. He's a powerful God. And there was a young Christian in the whole group, the youngest Christian. And he just stood up and says, oh, yeah, you watch tomorrow, it'll pour rain. And Jesus Christ is making it pour rain. And then the other Christians are all scared. They say, oh, man, don't be putting God to the test. And what if it don't rain? And they didn't have the faith. But this young Christian just said, I will show you. The next day, man, these priests got out there with their idol, Tai Wang. They put it up on this platform, and the priests are carrying it, and it starts raining. And then it starts pouring. It starts pouring, pouring, pouring. And the priests are slipping and sliding in the mud and the water, and the idol falls off, you know, their platform, and they're picking up, trying to straighten it up in all this rain. You know what I'm saying? Of course, some people believed in Jesus Christ. They turned to Christ. But the priests, of course, they say, well, it must not have been the right day. You know how people are. Yeah. But all I'm saying is, this is what it looks like to me with these evolutionists. They try to constantly prop this thing up, and it's pouring down rain. It's showing how foolish and idiotic the whole thing is. But I just see it. It just jumps out at me. It says their image are consigned to the beast and the cattle. Now, here's another thing, too. Remember God himself and the Ark of the Covenant. What happened when they consigned the Ark of the Covenant to beast? Anybody remember her? And the cattle?
Yeah, it tipped over. And then it was slain.
Interesting thing to me, God gave them specific instructions. He says, man, this ark needs to be carried on the priest's shoulders, elevating above men, showing that God is in control, that he's directing. But David, you know, he wanted to bring the ark into Jerusalem. And David was a man of God, a man after God's own heart. And he just figured, well, we'll just put the ark on a cart and have the cows pull it. And that's what they did.
Yeah.
And then the cows start stumbling and the ark starts swaying back and forth. And this guy, Uzzah, figured, well, I better steady this thing. He touches the ark and is struck dead.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything just stopped in its tracks. And then David got angry with God and said, why does this happen? But then, you know, it goes back to what Moses said, what God specifically said. Well, I see what we did wrong. We weren't honoring God. We weren't having the priest do this. So then, months later, they got the priest together, and then they took 6 paces, and they offered a sacrifice. But took another 6 paces and offered a sacrifice. Then they brought it to Jerusalem because, you know, they weren't throwing this thing on a cart, being pulled by animals. And what I'm saying is here, when you read this, it's easy to go over our heads, but you got to look at what it's saying. Baal has bowed down, Nabal stoops over, their images are consigned to the beast and the cattle, and the things you carry are burdensome, a load for the weary beast. What kind of God is that? Now, it says they stooped over, they have bowed down together, they could not rescue the burden, they have themselves gone into captivity. Isn't that amazing? It's like Babylon's being overrun, and their gods are going into captivity. They can't save them. Now, look at the contrast. God's going to contrast himself to these idols because he says in the first read, listen to me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel, you who have been born by me from birth and have been carried even from the womb. You see, there's a situation where these foolish people are trying to carry their gods. But God is saying, I'm carrying you. Mm-hmm. Right? And where does he carry him from? From their womb. from their inception, basically, but from their mother's womb, he's carrying this, all of his people. And then he says, even to your old age, I will be the same. And even to your graying years, I will bear you. I have done it, and I will carry you, and I will bear you, and I will deliver you. Now, that says a lot, because he says, even in your old age. Well, what does God say about people who are old? Anybody remember what they're going to be doing? You know, it says in Psalms, Psalm 92, God basically said this: the righteous man will flourish like a palm tree. He will grow like a cedar in Lebanon, planted in the house of the Lord. They will flourish in the courts of our God. They will still yield fruit in old age, and they shall be full of sap and very green. Do you declare that the Lord is upright? He is my rock, and there is no unrighteousness in him. In other words, he's saying that people who commit their lives to God, they're going to bear fruit even in old age. Now, I've been in and out of old folks' homes, retirement homes, convalescent homes, and there's people there. I mean, it's a sad thing that a lot of these old people, man, they just sit in a chair or lay on their bed and they just gaze mindlessly out the window or stare mindlessly at the TV, or they just slouched over in a wheelchair. Just, they're at the very threshold of death, just waiting to die. And I feel sorry for these people. But I also realize, you know what? God says, if you commit your life to me when you're young, you will bear fruit even in your old age. You'll be full of sap and very green. You may be still on your, you know, let's say on your deathbed, but you could still be producing fruit. How?
Prayer.
Mm-hmm. Prayer. And offer up your pain, your suffering to God for souls. You'll still be bearing fruit, right? So God is saying here, I will bear you and deliver you even in your old age, he said. And you, in that verse 4, even to your old age, I will be the same. And even to your graying years, I will bear you. I have done it, and I will carry you, and I will bear you, and I will deliver you. When did Solomon say to remember God?
In your youth.
In your youth. And why is it so important to remember God in our youth?
No, so you carry that with you through your life.
Time and life have a way of hardening us. It really does. And you know what? We're creatures of habit. And the habits that we develop when we're young, we're going to carry them over. They become, at first, they may be too light to be felt, but I'm telling you, after a lifetime, they will become iron cables. Mm-hmm. And they'll be too strong to break. In other words, you know, if we don't cultivate a spirit where we get along with God in prayer and reading His Word and fellowshipping and doing good works and putting God first in our life, we do this through habits. It's through habits. And if we don't cultivate those habits when we're young, chances are we're never going to do it when we're old. And then it'll be too late. If we get in the habit of reading God's Word every day and meditating upon it every day, if we get in the habit of coming to Bible study, going to fellowship, going to church, if we get in the habit of getting along with God, having a quiet time, witnessing, that type of stuff, those are habits that it requires discipline. But after a while, you know, it becomes second nature. And, you know, if all we do with our life is just sit on our behinds and watch 58 hours of TV a week, believe me, that's all we're going to be doing when we get old. That's it. So he says in that verse 5, to whom would you liken me and make me equal and compare me that we would be alike? Now, God is throwing out a question here. He says, who are you going to compare me to? Interesting thing. Anybody remember in the Gospel of John one of the reasons why people wanted to stone Jesus Christ?
Because he said he was God.
In John chapter 10, it says this. It says, I and the Father are one. The Jews picked up stones again to stone him, and Jesus answered them, I showed you many good works from the Father. For which of them are you stoning me? The Jews answered him, saying, for a good work we do not stone you, but for blasphemy, because you, being a man, make yourself out to be God. Now Jesus made himself out to be equal with his Father. He did. Over and over and over again. The Jews had no misconception about that. They saw it clearly. You're making yourself equal to be with God. So they were ready to stone him to death. But you read this right here, verse 5. To whom would you liken me and make me equal and compare me that we would be alike? Alright? That's Jesus Christ, I'm telling you right now. And verse 6. Those who lavish gold from the purse and weigh silver on a scale and hire a goldsmith and he makes it into a god and they bow down, indeed they worship it. And believe me, that's exactly what people do today when it comes to these sacred cows. I don't care if it's evolution. I don't care if it's abortion. I don't care any of these politically correct BS things that they come up with. These are gods. These are sacred cows, and they really go out of their way to try to present them as being valuable. And in verse 7 it says, they lift it up on their shoulders and carry it. They set it in its place, and they stand there, and it does not move from its place. Though one may cry to it, it cannot answer. It cannot deliver him from distress. Remember this and be assured. Recall it to mind, you transgressors. Remember the former things long past. For I am God, and there is no other. I am God, and there is no one like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times, things that have not been done, saying, my purpose will be established, and I will accomplish it all my good pleasure. Let's just back up just a minute. In that verse 7, he says he's basically mocking what people do when it comes to these idols. And it's very easy for people today to read this and just figure, well, these people are a bunch of ignoramuses that lived thousands of years ago, and they propped up this gold idol, this wooden idol, this silver idol, and then they bowed down and did homage to it. But I'm telling you, they're all over the place today. He says they lift it up on their shoulders, they carry it, they set it in this place, and it stands there, it does not move from its place. Though one may cry to it, it cannot answer, it cannot deliver him from distress. And I was teaching a men's Bible study Tuesday, and I basically said that the first religious act of man was to make fig leaves and, you know, cover his behind because he was naked and ashamed, right? And that was a religious act, trying to become presentable to God. But then I talked about how it says in Revelations, it says that when the wicked see Jesus Christ coming back in great power, great glory, where every eye is going to see him, and when the wicked see him coming, they're going to say to the mountains and the rocks and the hills to fall upon us and hide us from the face of him who sits upon the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. Now, I said that is a religious act. Why do I say that's a religious act?
That's their covering. That's what they want to cover with? The rocks?
Who are they praying to?
The rocks.
The rocks.
Mm-hmm.
The rocks. I'm not stretching this. These people, they're so desperate. They're crying out to the rocks, fall on us and crush us into oblivion to hide us in the face of God. That's how scared they are. But who are they praying to? That's prayer. It really is. It's a religious act. I don't know. Most people can't see that, but I do.
It's similar to, like Greg said, they're asking for a covering like Adam and Eve did with this.
Right. That's true. That's true. But
cover.
Right. And look at that latter part of that verse 7. Though one may cry to it, it cannot answer. It cannot deliver them from its distress. That's going to be the ultimate right there. It really is. In the very end, men are going to be crying to the rocks and the hills to fall on them. Like Greg said, to hide them, right? You know, they're going to try to hide from God. Their first religious act was try to hide from God. Their last religious act is going to try to hide from God. And they're going to be praying for the mountain of the hill. If we are not going to put God where he belongs, then we're going to put something in his place. And it's going to be a stone idol. Even by these quote-unquote intelligent people, they're going to be crying out to the rocks. And in verse 8 says, remember this and be assured, recall it to mind, you transgressors. I mean, it's almost like, hey man, wake up, smell the coffee, man, do the right thing. In verse 9, remember the former things are long past, for I am God and there is no other. I am God, there is no one like me. Look at the gods today. I mean, they're all over. There's an endless pantheon of gods today. They're just all over. And you don't have to go to India to see them. They're all over here. They're all over everywhere. Anything that we put before God becomes an idol. And it says, verse 10, declaring the end from the beginning and from the ancient times, things which have not been done, saying, my purpose will be established and I will accomplish all my good pleasure. Now, what does that mean? Verse 10. Especially for anybody sleeping. What does that mean?
He knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, look at that verse 9. He says, for I am God, there is no other. I am God, there is no one like me. And then he says, declaring the end from the beginning. Meaning, hey man, I have predicted, I foretold all this stuff that's going to happen. Everything that God has said has come to pass as far as prophecy. We're reading Isaiah here. Isaiah 53. It's only like 12, 13 verses. It talks about the death and the burial of Jesus Christ. It talks about him being crucified between two thieves. It talks about him being buried in a rich man's grave. It talks about his resurrection. As a new Christian, I read Isaiah 53, and I could not believe it. It just blew me away. I just said, I can't believe it. Is this in the Jewish Bible? And I literally went down to the nearest synagogue I could find on Riverside Boulevard, and I talked to a lady down there. I said, look, could I buy one of your Bibles? And she sold me a Bible. I got it right in there. And I took it home, and I read Isaiah 53. I said, my gosh, it's right there in front of them. How could they not see this? right? Mm-hmm. And because God is saying right here, he's saying, declaring the end from the beginning and from the ancient times things which have not been done, saying, my purpose will be established and I will accomplish all my good pleasure. Next time you're in a grocery store, pick up any tabloid you see there, pick it up while you're waiting in line, thumb through it real quick, and count, just count the number of psychics, of advertisements that there are. Psychics, fortune tellers, prognosticators, people who are going to predict the future, or this type of thing. Just count them all. And yet, none of their predictions come true. These people are not divinely inspired, but God is saying, yes, I will accomplish my purpose and my good pleasure. People just foo-foo the Bible, they just throw it aside, and then they go looking at all these other places where it's just, these people don't have any wisdom, any enlightenment. They couldn't tell you anything. And in verse 11 it says, calling a bird of prey from the east, the man of my purpose from a far country, truly I have spoken, truly I will bring it to pass. I have planted, I surely I will do it. Now, if you tell me what it's talking about here. Verse 11. Remember last week's Bible study? God predicted a man by the name of Cyrus would come upon the scene. He would be a Persian king. Interesting to me, God predicted this guy would come upon the scene 150 to almost 200 years before he came to power. God called him by name. He identified him by name. And God said that he will be my shepherd. And God referred to him as being his servant. And God would use Cyrus as the instrument that would let his people go from Babylon back to Israel. Right? This is all before the fact. He's mentioning it here. That's why he's saying, calling a bird of prey from the east. That's what he did. He called Cyrus from the east. He says, a man of my purpose from a far country. Truly I have spoken, truly I will bring it to pass. I have planned it, surely I will do it. And then he says here, listen to me, you stubborn-minded who are far from righteousness. I bring near my righteousness. It is not far off, and my salvation will not delay. I will grant salvation in Zion and my glory for Israel. Now, he says a mouthful here. He really does. And he's not mincing around with words. He says, listen to me. Now, this is God speaking. You stubborn-minded. Now, are we surrounded by stubborn-minded people?
Yep.
I mean, I got an average IQ. These guys, their IQs are off the charts, man. They really are. A lot of these scientists, but I'm telling you right now, a lot of these people who have this tremendous IQ and they got all these educational degrees, I really believe in my heart of hearts, they should be out on the forefront and proclaiming the glory of God. But so many of them are like this buffoon right here, just saying, well, it all happened because of gravity. That's exactly what God does. I mean, Jesus Christ said it to the scribes, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the intelligentsia of his day. He says, I thank thee, Father, that thou hast hidden these things from the wise and the prudent of this age and revealed them to babes, revealed them to infants, all right? God does that. If a person's just proud, he just hides himself from them. And we are told in Romans chapter 1 and 2, he talks about how these people, they profess to be wise, but they become utter fools because they will not give God the glory, the thanks, or anything else. And right. So what happens is God gives them over to a depraved mind. All right, and I'm telling you right now, these so-called scientists, they do not intimidate me. They just do not. Because I know this, you could take all the most intelligent people that ever lived and you could take all their knowledge and put it all together, and I'm telling you what, right now, it wouldn't fill up a thimble next to the ocean of what they do not know. Mm-hmm. And that they prayed around like the emperor with no clothes, thinking that they just know it all. And I'm not trying to be insulting, but I do get angry with these people because I'm thinking, you know what? You know who should be on the forefront of proclaiming the glory of God, in my opinion, is doctors. How could you look at the human body, the human eye? How can you look at the ear, the nose, the mouth, and just say, oh, it just came out of a mud hole, man. It just all came from snot. You guys are full of baloney. You're certifiable, and I get sick and tired of hearing it. I would say to every scientist who claims to be a Christian, I said, you know what I do? I challenge you to take your great learning and use it in a way to glorify God by taking his word and showing it as best you can how scientifically there is a God. Now, you can't prove that any more than you can prove evolution. You can't prove it. It comes to a point where faith takes over. But how much faith does it take to believe that we just came out of a big bang in comparison to the faith that there's an intelligent design behind all this intelligent design? All I'm saying is this. I challenge all these people with all the great learning to say, man, use your brain, man, because God says, hey, he's given us our mind to love him with all of our mind. And I really believe that, hey man, if you've got a great deal of intelligence, it's a blessing of God, so use it to glorify him. Don't use it to come up with all this baloney about coming out of a mud hole. Look at this verse 12. Listen to me, you stubborn-minded who are far from righteousness. Now, here's the thing. God says they're far from righteousness, but what would you bet, what would you want to bet that if you went back in Isaiah's day and stuck a microphone in everybody's face and say, do you consider yourself to be a righteous person? How many people do you think you're going to find that are going to say, well, I'm a sinner, man. I'm on my way to hell. I'm just a monster of iniquity. I need a salvation. So he's talking to these stubborn people.
Well, nothing's changed.
Right, nothing's changed. He says, who are far from righteousness? They're going to look at you like, who, me, a good person? What are you talking about? You know. But he says here, I bring near my righteousness. Now, what's God's righteousness?
Jesus Christ.
Jesus Christ is our righteousness. We've got to put on Jesus Christ. Otherwise, we have no righteousness. What did Isaiah say our righteousness is?
Filthy rags.
It's filthy rags. That's our righteousness, not our wickedness. God says, man, your righteousness stinks, man. It's given off an aroma. It stinks to high heaven. Your righteousness. Okay? So God provides a righteousness through Jesus Christ. He says, I bring near my righteousness. It is not far off. You know, God's salvation is not far off. It really isn't. People don't want anything to do with it. And I'm telling you right now, people who view themselves as being basically good and they don't need Jesus Christ and they get to heaven if there is one, man, they're far off. They are far off. He says, I bring near my righteousness. It is not far off, and my salvation will not delay, and I will grant salvation in Zion. What's Zion?
People.
Okay, Zion points to Jerusalem, but it has a much broader connotation to speak of God's people. That I grant my salvation in Zion and my glory for Israel. Our salvation is in Jesus Christ, and there is no salvation apart from Him. And Peter says, there's no other name in heaven by which we must be saved other than Jesus Christ. And today, that's so politically incorrect, people just want to railroad you off the cliff because they just figure, you know, are you going to tell me that all these other people who believe in Buddha or Confucius or Muhammad or they're Hindu or they're, you know, they bow down to Krishna or they're Muslims? Or, hey man, I didn't say it. It's Jesus Christ is saying it. You know, there's only one way to God, and that's through Him.
That's such a radical statement that
I know people just
forces
are gonna,
them to either say it's Jesus or Muhammad.
Yeah.
Or no, it's just Jesus. It's the only way.
Well, it was Jesus Christ who said it, not me. If it was up to me, I'd say, I don't care. What you could be a Satanist. I don't care. You'll go to heaven. But that's not what Jesus Christ is saying. Anybody have one to add or share to this? Okay, let's just quickly go through this chapter 47. I don't think it'll take us that long because I think it's easy reading. It says in verse 1 of chapter 47, Isaiah says, come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground without a throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no longer be called tender and delicate. Take the millstones and grind meal. Remove your veil, strip off the skirt, uncover the leg, cross the rivers. Your nakedness will be uncovered. Your shame will also be exposed. I will take vengeance and will not spare a man. Now, interesting thing. It says here, come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Now, what does it mean, virgin daughter?
Pure.
Well, put it this way. Where did Babylon originate?
When did it?
No, yeah, when and where?
Tower of Babel.
Yeah. Got to go back to Genesis. And God says this in Genesis chapter 11. Now, the whole earth used the same language and the same words, and it came about as they were journeying east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. Now, right. How many people know what the land of Shinar is?
Is it like in Turkey?
No. Babylon. It's the ancient name for Babylon. Oh. All right? It says they found a plain in the land of Shinar, or Babylon, and settled there. But in the previous chapter, it talks about Nimrod. It says, he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel in the land of Shinar. And then we're talking about here the land of Shinar. And it said that it came about that as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they used bricks for stone and they used them for the tar for mortar. And they said, come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into the heavens and let us make for ourselves a name. Otherwise we will be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they have the same language. And this is what they began to do, and now nothing which they propose will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and there and confuse their language so that they will not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore, its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. Now, I backed up that far. to go all the way back to the origins of Babylon. She is known as the mother of harlots, okay? Here's the thing. It was in Babylon that two things took place there that turns men's hearts from God. It was in this city of Babel, or Babel, that they began to really get involved in all kinds of witchcraft and idolatry and sorcery and astrology. She became the mother of harlots, right? But also something else began there, it appears. And that was the beginning of currency, the beginning of money. You see, so when you go to Revelations chapter 17, God talks about a judgment upon a whore of Babylon, which is the religious whore, which is an amalgamation of all these false religious systems of the world that had its birth way back there in Babylon. But then in chapter 18, God deals with the economic whore. Jesus Christ said this, you cannot serve two masters. You cannot serve God and money. You're either going to love one or hate the other, or cleave to one, despise the other. No man can serve God and money. But how many people put money before God?
No, most of people.
Like I said many times, if I ran an ad in the paper, says everybody shows up to Bible study here tonight, I'll give you $1,000. Well, we're going to put them all right? Or if you say, well, I'll give you $1,000 if you go to church Sunday, where are you going to put them all then? All I'm saying is it because Jesus Christ is in our midst? No, it's because the real God showed up. People may think that's kind of harsh, but all I'm saying is, hey, man, we got to understand this, that it's so easy to put money before God. It originated in Babylon, all right, this love of money, which is the root of all sorts of evil.
Tower of Babel is that it was God confused. They wanted to become a one-world government there. The same way we're looking at today in the United Nations.
Yes, it was. See, interesting thing, we're not told this in the Bible, but I read this in the book of Josephus, that God kept telling his people, he kept telling mankind, he says, I want you to spread out, I want you to spread out, I want you to spread out. And Nimrod came along and said, no, don't spread out. We're going to build a city, we're going to build a tower, and he wanted to control all these people. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Mm-hmm. And so all the people say, okay, we'll build this tower. And the reason they were building this tower, they weren't stupid. All right, they weren't third grade educated pigs thinking that, well, we can look into heaven. But what they were doing is they were trying to build this huge massive tower as an observatory platform so they could calculate the movement of the stars and then come up with their horoscopes and everything else. That's why it's called the mother of harlots. So it was Nimrod who said, I want one world government here and I'm going to be in charge. So, and then God just went down there and says, okay, I'll just confound your language. That way he got him to spread out. Mm-hmm. Alright, I know I'm all over the map here, but that's what he's talking about here. When he's talking about Babylon, there's a specific judgment for Babylon. Keep this in mind. Babylon was overthrown by the Medes and the Persians, but Babylon has never experienced, never in all of her history, has ever experienced a violent overthrow the way the prophets predict. Okay, you go back to Revelation 18, you go back to the writings of Jeremiah. Babylon has a specific judgment for it. It's going to be overthrown violently. Now tell me right now, where's Babylon today?
Iraq.
It's Iraq. All right? And it has had a long, long decline. As a matter of fact, it used to be called just a small village called Hilla. That's how much it was reduced to. And then eventually, they unearthed Babylon. And then under Saddam Hussein, before he got hung, he spent millions, 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 millions of dollars rebuilding the city. Now, granted, it's not completely rebuilt, but there are literally millions of bricks with his name on it. Mm-hmm. In the rebuilding of this Babylon. And this Babylon is going to come back into prominence in the last 7 years of the world. And it's going to become an economic metropolis, believe it or not, and the Antichrist is going to have that as basically the economic nerve center of the world. But it has a special judgment where it's going to go up in smoke, because no less than three times in Revelation chapter 18, it says that in 1 hour, this thing goes up in flames, and it says that the merchants of the sea, and everybody stands at a distance, weeping and mourning and wailing and throwing dust in their head, saying, whoa, whoa, the great city Babylon, and then they won't go near it out of fear of her torment, suggesting to me that it's a nuclear destruction that God has in mind for this. And then not only that, at the very, very end of the world, there's going to be a global earthquake. And it appears, if you look at the Persian Gulf there, in my opinion, this is speculative, but when this global earthquake happens, that Persian Gulf is going to split open and the entire sea is going to cover Babylon, cover it, because that's what God describes. It's going to be buried like a millstone thrown into the sea. That's the judgment God has for this. So if you take that verse 2, take the millstones and the grind mill and remove your veil, strip off your skirt, uncover your leg, cross the rivers, your nakedness will be uncovered, your shame also will be exposed. I will take vengeance and will not spare a man. Now, when God is saying, he's speaking symbolic here, but he says your nakedness will be uncovered. What does that mean?
Well, they're ashamed. Their phoniness. I don't know.
Well, their sinfulness. God is going to uncover our nakedness as a nation. Now, what do I mean by that?
Show forth our sins.
Okay, here's the thing. We're living in a day and age where we are calling good evil and evil good. We have slaughtered over 51 million unborn children, and we call this a choice. But there's coming a day when God is going to uncover our nakedness and show this for what it is. Mm-hmm. This is flat-out murder. This is genocide. This is mass killing. Same thing with all this homosexual agenda, gay marriage, the whole nine yards. Now, people today say, well, you're just homophobic, you're just intolerant, you're just a bigot, you're just a good for nothing. I'm saying, man, I don't give a hoot who you marry. I really don't. I just do not. I don't care if you're gay. I don't care if you're homosexual. I don't care what you are. I say more power to you. Do whatever you want to do. But I'm telling you, that's not God's message. God's message says, man, this is sin. And you don't repent of this, you're going to be eternally damned. Now, people will look at me and just be in my face over that. And I'm saying, hey, man, I did not say it. I didn't say it. It's God that's saying it. And there will come a day when he will strip off all his veneer of all his phony talk and all this doublespeak about how righteous we are. And he will expose our shame. He will expose our wickedness. That's what he's going to do. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he says this in verse 4. Our Redeemer, the Lord of the hosts, is his name, the Holy One of Israel. Here it is. He's our Redeemer. Jesus Christ is our Redeemer. There's only one Redeemer. What does it mean to redeem?
Purchase.
You give something in exchange. He gave his life in exchange for us. All right? Our Redeemer, the Lord of hosts is his name, the Holy One of Israel. That's Jesus Christ. He says, sit silently and go into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans. Now, who are the Chaldeans?
Babylonians.
For you will no longer be called the Queen of the Kingdoms. All right? You know, she was riding high on a hog. And she is going to be at the very end of the world, both religiously and economically. But God has a specific judgment for her. In verse 6, it says, I was angry with my people. I profaned my heritage, and I gave them into your hand. I did not show mercy to them. On the age, you made your yoke very heavy. Yet you said, I will be a queen forever. These things you did not consider nor remember the outcome of them. Now then, hear this, you sensual one who dwells securely, who says in your heart, I am, and there is no one besides me. I will not sit as a widow, nor no loss of children. But these two things will come on you suddenly in one day, loss of children and widowhood, and they will come on you in full measure in spite of your many sorceries, in spite of your great power of your spells. Now, before we go any further, God is speaking specifically to Babylon here. And he's talking about in verse 6, I was angry with my people, I profaned my heritage, I gave them into your hand. In other words, God used the Babylonians to chasten his people. This was almost 100 years before it took place. That because God's people got into so much idolatry and wickedness and immorality and godlessness and everything else, God used the Babylonians to chastise them. But the Babylonians overstepped their bounds, and then the Babylonians began to feel like, hey, we're our own God.
Mm-hmm.
So God has a special judgment for them, because it says in that verse 7, yet you said, I will be a queen forever. These things you did not consider, nor remember the outcome of them. And now then, hear this, you sensual one. He's talking to Babylon as being a sensual one. Now, you can apply this spiritually, but also you could take it literally. So what does that suggest about you as far as Babylon? Being a sensual one.
Sexual sin, right?
Yeah. Look at us today. Would you consider our country to be a sensual country, a sensual nation?
Absolutely.
You can't watch a TV commercial without seeing some half-naked lady sitting on 50 pounds of steer manure trying to sell it.
Yeah.
Right? Now, what's the connection? There's no connection. You know, I don't care whether it's peat moss or whatever else. You've got half-naked people on there because it's sensual, right? I mean, this is what we're dealing with. We become a sensual country. People are just addicted to pornography on the internet everywhere you go. Well, that's the way Babylon was in many respects, all right? And he had a judgment for them, but it says in verse 8, I am, and there is no one besides me. This is what happens when a country does away with God. This country has said this, I am, and there is no one besides me.
Mm-hmm.
We have run God out of our schools and out of our courts, out of our judicial system, out of everywhere you turn. You know, God has been running out of town on a rail. So we're saying, hey, we're the one. There's no one besides us. And we just feel like, well, we'll look at God as a cuddly mascot. We'll throw him a bone as long as he stays in his place and don't put any demands on us. That's the way we treat God in this country. It really is. And it just angers the heck out of me. And verse 9 says, but these two things will come on you suddenly one day. Loss of children and widowhood, and they will come on you in full measure in spite of your many sorceries. Now, this has never really happened to them. Suddenly, it did under the Medes and the Persians, but they were not totally destroyed. As a matter of fact, I think it was Herodias and other historians tell us that Babylon had been captured, and 3 days later, a lot of people didn't even know it in the city. So it wasn't a violent overthrow, but God has a specific judgment for Babylon as being a violent overthrow, and this is talking about it here. And then he says, in spite of your sorceries and your spells, it says, you felt secure in your wickedness and said, no one sees me. Your wisdom and your knowledge, they have deluded you, for you have said in your heart, I am, and there is no one besides me. Now just showing the evolutionists here, okay, the hardcore evolutionists, right? Your wisdom and your knowledge, they have deluded you, for you have said in your heart that we all came from apes. And there's no one besides me. They've been deluded. And verse 11, but evil will come on you, which you will not know how to charm away, and disaster will fall on you, for which you cannot atone, and destruction about which you do not know will come on you suddenly. Again, there it is. It's going to come upon them suddenly, right? Now, look at this. God says, stand fast now in your spells and in your many sorceries in which you have labored from your youth. Perhaps you will be able to profit. Perhaps you may cause trembling. You are wearied with your many counsels. Let now the astrologers, those who prophesy by the stars and those who predict the new moons, to stand up and save you from what will come upon you. Behold, they have become like stubble. Fire burns them. They cannot deliver themselves from the power of the flame. There will be no coal to warm by, nor fire to sit before. So have those become to you with whom you have labored, who have trafficked with you from your youth. Each has wandered in his own way. There is none to save you. Now, this is what I'm talking about. It was in Babylon that they basically, that was the mother of harlots. That was the beginning of all this witchcraft and sorceries and spells and charms and spiritism. And it all began there. She's the mother of harlots. You see all these false religions today. I don't care whether it's cults. I don't care whether Jehovah's Witnesses or Mormons. I don't care if it's false religions like Islam or Hinduism or Buddhism. Guess what? It all had its origin back there in Babylon. This is the mother of harlots. She is giving birth to every cult, every false teaching, every philosophy that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, every false religious system, this is where it originated from, and God has a special judgment for them. But when the Babylonians, of course, they put their faith and they put their trust into what? They put it into their sorcery.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because he says, stand fast now in your spells and your men in sorcery. What is sorcery?
Witchcraft.
Yeah, it's witchcraft. God has a lot to say about witchcraft. He says in Leviticus, as for the person who turns to mediums and to spiritists and to plays a harlot after them, I will also set my face against that person and I will cut him off from among his people. He also says in Leviticus, he says, now a man or a woman who is a medium or a spiritist shall surely be put to death. They shall be stoned with stones. Their blood guiltiness is upon them. And also in Leviticus 19, it said this, do not turn to mediums or to spiritists. Do not seek them out to be defiled by them. I am the Lord your God. You shall rise up before. Okay, so anyway, what I'm saying is this. What's a medium?
Fortune teller, or let the devil occupy their body, basically.
Yeah, any kind of a go-between between the spirit world and the physical world. Okay, I don't care if you're in a seance and you got a person there. They go into a trance and then they literally are taken over by a demonic spirit. The spirit will speak through them. Now, everybody at this table and around this seance here is trying to conjure up some Aunt Bozo, and instead, this medium has now gone into a trance where this demon is speaking to this person. A lot of times he will speak with the same voice of this deceased person, all right, to deceive these people, thinking, well, this is Aunt Bozo. And, you know, I don't care whether it's seances, I don't care whether it's Ouija boards, tarot cards, just throw it out there, palm reading, all these things. Fortune tellers, palm readers, they're all mediums in the sense that they're go-betweens. This is what God says, stay away from them. Anybody know where the last place God mentions sorcery is? Well, Revelation chapter 21, God said this. He said, but for the cowardly and the unbelieving and the abominable and the murderers and the immoral persons and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars, their part will be in the lake of fire, the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. And in the last book, the last chapter of the Bible, the last chapter, chapter 22 of Revelation, almost the last thing that is said is outside of the dogs and the sorcerers and the immoral persons and the murderers and the idolaters and everyone who loves and practices lying. Jesus said, don't give what is holy to dogs to throw your pearls to swine, because they're going to turn on you. So what kind of dogs? Dogs, I tell you right now, virtually everybody in the ACLU is a dog. Now, they'll probably sue me for saying that, but they are. They're dogs. They'll be at you. They attack you for your faith in Christ. These are dogs. These are the ones who attack you because of your faith. All right? Outside of the dog. But he says also outside of the sorcerers. Now, I'm no Greek scholar, but sorcery, they get this Greek word pharmakia from sorcery. Okay, it means drugs. People are just being ruined with drugs. They get hooked on drugs and then they go out and commit all kinds of crime, you know, to support their habit. This is sorcery. All right? It's a form of sorcery. And anyway, God says, man, when his judgments come, all this kind of sorcery, witchcraft, all this stuff is not going to save them. And there's no way that they're going to get away from God's judgments upon this kind of stuff when people are trafficking with demons, because that's exactly what they're doing. Joey's asleep over there, so yeah, right. What are you doing? You meditating?
Yeah. Praying for you.
Yeah. Well, all right. Anybody have any want to add or share?
Yeah.